Welcome to the London Walks podcast.
This episode
goes to London 2014, part 2,
presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
Now, last year, Adam and I spoke to Phil, the very kindly and supremely knowledgeable verger at St. Bartholomew the Great. He is now retired and is a brother at Charterhouse next door. I met up with him this week at a pub nearby called The Hand and Shears, where he very kindly agreed to talk to me about ghostly goings-on, plague and execution at Charterhouse.
Because that acre of land that is Charterhouse Square was used intentionally and originally for a graveyard, nothing has been built on it, of course, and so it's been intact. When Crossrail came to do their digging for their Farringdon station, they had to dig along the side of it. And strangely enough, they found 26 skeletons laid in a neat order. Layered, there were about three layers with a layer of mud in between each one to keep any sort of bad plague things seeping out. And they were all facing east, so they had a proper burial. Now, they weren't sure that they were plague victims, so they dug them up. They actually brought them into Charterhouse and put them on display in our cloister for a couple days. So we had a first-hand look at them. And then they came back to report that when they tested the bones, because the Black Death had evolved from a bubonic plague, which was carried by fleas on rats, to a pneumonic plague, which was passed by breath. That's why the Black Plague spread so quickly from in a family and from house to house in a matter of months. And they tested the bones, and the bones had not been exposed to the bubonic plague so that the DNA did not absorb any of it, but they went into the tooth and the polyp, that liquid center of the tooth, and there they were able to trace. It's the same plague that is still around in the world. It's dotted in seven continents and really infesting Madagascar, where it's the worst. So that's a connection that we have had all these years with that death. It was incredible because we heard stories about ghosts at Charterhouse. I've only been there a year now, retired from St. Bartholomew the Great. But it's a very interesting place in the fact that it started out as a burial ground for Black Plague victims. Yeah. You know, in December 1348, January 1349, the city of London was hit so hard, they say that the church graveyards were absolutely full, and they had to find space outside to bury them. So Walter de Manny decided that he was going to buy 16 acres from St. Bartholomew's hospital, or priory and hospital, in order to give those people a perfect and decent burial. They died such a horrendous death that he thought they should be buried with prayers and in a proper fashion. So that Charterhouse Square, which Charterhouse still owns, became the burial ground, although nothing's ever been built on it. That's why excavation right there by Crossrail okay has uncovered all kinds of things.
Recently, very recently.
Yes, skeletons and such. But there are bones, they think, I mean, that extend the whole 16 acres, even as far as the Barbican Station and up past Clerkenwell Road. So that was about 1348, 1349. He also put a chapel there because he wanted them to be prayed for continuously for the souls. You know how superstitious they were in those days. Yeah. You know, there was purgatory they had to get through and then on to heaven or hell. So he established a chapel. And then about 20 years later, around 1371, he decided what a good idea it would be to actually establish a monastery. And he thought the monastic orders in London were a bit risque in some regard, you know. And he thought the Carthusians are the most strict. Maybe he'd get an order of Carthusians to come down and show him how it was meant to be. So he made an appeal to the Pope and to the King, and a Carthusian monastery was started shortly after, around 1352. And the monks were vegetarian, they were solitary, they were great writers, thinkers, studiers. They took everything very, very seriously. Of course, they lived alone, and they were unmarried.
So a very, very strict order.
The strictest.
Which even Thomas More wouldn't.
Even Thomas More, when he was studying law, he spent 4 years there thinking about doing this. Is before he was married, of course, and he thought it was just too much. And even today, there is one Carthusian monastery in England, and people go there, and we hear stories about them only staying a short time because it's just too. I mean, they wore hair shirts, and they still do. And they have this, and they don't have any sort of communication with each other, hardly at all. But that's the way they want to do it. And that was one of the reasons why they suffered the way that they did. But the monastery was dissolved. The property went back to the crown. And then it went to a man by the name of Edward North, and later Lord North. And he decided to tear down the monastic buildings, most of them, and build a grand Tudor house. He wanted a Tudor place to live. So it was established 1537 to 1545. He lived there.
Right.
And then he decided to sell it. Well, it went back to the crown, and then it was sold to the Duke of Norfolk, the fourth Duke of Norfolk,
yeah.
Who was in cahoots with Mary, Queen of Scots, and he wanted to get Elizabeth off the throne and possibly
have was
her.
He? Was he? Was
well, it? We think so. We think so. Right. We think he wanted to marry her, you know, and that was the plan.
Yep.
That's why in the Great Chamber, in the ceiling there, you'll find Scottish thistles and English oak into the plaster carving, which is a bit of a giveaway.
Yep.
We have, of course, communication with the Duke of Norfolk these days, and he verifies any of this stuff, you know, whether or not he's his great, 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 great.
It ended quite badly for him, didn't it?
Well, in 1372, he lost his head. But by that time, it had gone to his son, who was the Earl of Suffolk. He wanted to build something in Audley End.
Right.
And so he had this house that was given to him, and he ended up selling it to Thomas Sutton. And Thomas Sutton wanted to establish a charity. So that's where the brothers came, and there was a school established also at the same time for 40 needy students,
right.
80 old men,
yep.
And 40 boys. It's a collaboration you wouldn't find these days, I don't think.
No.
And they lived there, and it became a wonderful charity. The school, shortly after being founded, began taking in fee-paying guests.
Right.
And my American friends have always been surprised at public schools being private schools.
Yeah,
it's because they were public schools to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
They were for people who couldn't afford it, yeah. But then they became private, and they're just still called public schools.
Okay.
So Sutton did his bit. He was the wealthiest commoner in the country, and he bought it from the Earl of Suffolk, and he then established it as a home for himself. And the brothers were housed there, and it became a very, very, very important charity. The most expensive charity in the City of London, and in fact, at that time, probably in the country.
Wow.
It was well endowed. He left £76,000, which in today's money is about $200 million.
Sorry. My gosh.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we live there today. You have to be of needy substance, over 60, in good health, wanting to live in a community, and they welcome people who are in that position. So
okay.
I'm very, very blessed to be there. Now, I've been talking to the brothers about various stories that I've heard, and I've been making appeals for things, because I have heard in some cases that the Duke of Norfolk, since he was beheaded, he's been seen coming down the great stairs with his head in his arm. We think that's a good story, but it doesn't make much sense. He was not killed there. And it would be, I guess for a ghost, it would be all right to walk around with your head in your arm. We talked to someone else who said that we had a brother there who just recently passed away who had a great connection with the Duke of Norfolk. He used to, they used to interact all the time. And then we discovered that he was on medication that might have aided in that. So I can't give credence to that too much. The boys in the school were known to write a lot of ghost stories.
Right.
The place was somewhat haunting and had an atmosphere about it. 200 years ago, Washington Irving walked through it, and he's written a wonderful description of his time there, how the atmosphere was so dark and sort of...
I mean, this is 14th century, isn't it? I mean, you know, this is 700, getting on for kind of 650 years old or so, isn't it?
But we go back all the way to the 14th century, the monastery. So the boys are said to like to write ghost stories, but that's what boys will do. I'm told that on the 4th of May, when the Prior Houghton and the monks that were not willing to sign the Act of Supremacy were taken to the Tower, and then they were dragged from there to Tyburn,
right.
And the Tyburn Tower, which was a triangular wooden erection with eight people hung on each side of it. So there were 24 they could hang at one time.
And this is where Marble Arch stands.
This is where Marble Arch stands. And if you look on the pavement there, there is a round plaque thing in it showing where Tyburn Tree would have been. Mm. They were dragged by horses from the tower. It said that Thomas More was in the tower at the same time, and because he'd spent 4 years at Charterhouse, he knew these brothers, and he was with his daughter Meg, and he looked out the window and saw them being taken off to be executed, and he said they looked like bridegrooms on the way to the wedding. The analogy being that Christ is symbolized as the bridegroom of the church, and that they were being martyred for their faith proudly and with no fear or thought of changing their mind. So they were taken there. On 4th of May, that was, we do a service at Charterhouse for remembrance of the brothers who were martyred there. And we get the Tyburn nuns who come from the Tyburn nunnery in...
Marble Arch, Tyburn.
Yeah, and they were...
in the village of Tyburn, wouldn't it, originally?
Yeah, yes, and they were established to pray continuously, 24 hours a day, for Catholic martyrs, and now for English martyrs, and they still do. They still do. They had to get special dispensation to come out on the 4th of May to come join us for the service. But they're lovely. They're very supportive, and we even have Methodists, because John Wesley was a student at school. We have Methodists join us and Roman Catholics, and it's quite an ecumenical service. But there's a story that on the 4th of May, strangely in the chapel, there's a red stain that appears on the tile floor. And, of course, this would be suggestive that it was a remembrance of John Houghton and his fellow brothers. But then it's also possible, and I hate to sort of burst anyone's bubble, but the sunlight could cast its rays through some of the stained glass, and it possibly could put a red mark on the floor. We're not sure, but it's a good story anyway. Our development director, when I approached him about this sort of thing, he said, "Well, I've got a picture on my phone that one of the contractors took. Let me show it to you." So I went out to his office, and he downloaded it, and it was a corridor, and at the very end of it, he showed it to his assistant and said, "Catherine, what does that look like?" And she said, "Well, it could actually be a monk in sort of a gray cloak carrying a candle." And so then he showed it to me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Well, it could look like that. You're absolutely right. But you and I both know that that's where the water cooler is. So we're not going to say one way or the other."
I think it was a monk.
let's pretend it is. And then, of course, there are things like sounds in the chapel late at night that people complain about. The brothers ring the security guard, and they say there's noise coming from the chapel, only to find out days later that the organist was actually rehearsing and maybe he wasn't doing such a good job.
Now, what happened to Prior Harrison?
Yeah, he was hanged, drawn, and quartered, and then to make an example of him, his head was put, of course, on Tower Bridge, but his right quarter was nailed to the very door that we have in our gatehouse. It's a large archway. If you come by outside, you can't come in, but you can see the archway next to the porter's lodge, and you'll see the door where his quarter was hanged as an example that this is what happens to you when you mess with the king. Some of them signed the Act of Supremacy. Some ran away. The younger ones ran away to Europe. It was very ghoulish.
Yep.
And certainly appropriate for this time of year, I guess. So I just wanted to tell you about two brothers that I asked about ghosts. One of us is Philip Bacon, who does the tours. He said, "Philip, sorry, but no ghosts. Perhaps because the Carthusian martyrs and the Duke of Norfolk were killed elsewhere." And then I had another brother who's a wonderful character. And he said to me, "Dear Phil, in the light of several major histories of the London Charterhouse, it would seem that ghosts in Charterhouse are analogous to snakes in Ireland. ... There are no snakes in Ireland."
I had now arrived at that particular point of my walk where four roads met. The road to Hampstead, along which I had returned, the road to Finchley, the road to West End, and the road back to London. I had mechanically turned in this latter direction and was strolling along the lonely high road, idly wondering, I remember, what the Cumberland young ladies would look like when, in one moment, every drop of blood in my body was brought to a stop by the touch of a hand laid lightly and suddenly on my shoulder from behind me. I turned on the instant with my fingers tightening round the handle of my stick. There, in the middle of the broad, bright high road, there, as if it had at that moment sprung out of the earth or dropped from the heaven, stood the figure of a solitary woman, dressed from head to foot in white garments, her face bent in grave inquiry on mine, her hand pointing to the dark cloud over London as I faced her. I was far too seriously startled by the suddenness with which this extraordinary apparition stood before me in the dead of night and in that lonely place to ask what she wanted. The strange woman spoke first. "Is that the road to London?" she said.
Karen Pierce Goulding was reading from The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins, the location of which features on our Hampstead Walk. This Friday, the 31st of October, Halloween, all four London Walk's ghost tours will be at large. For full details, please visit our website, www.walks.com. Thanks for listening.
The London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.